Okay, so I want to start by sharpening a distinction that we made last week. We talked about the Rambam versus Reb Tzadok in terms of their understandings of the history of halacha, and we're going to see some Reb Tzadok inside tonight, but I want to sort of map out again, you know, what the differences between them and why those differences are so crucial. For Rambam, everything is given at Sinai in potential. The rules, meaning the material is given, and the rules for interpreting the material are given. If you want to compare it to a genome, right, DNA, then, you know, within that first cell of an organism, there's already the blueprint for how that organism is going to develop. So the Rambam understands the development of Torah Shebaal Peh as being that the genome is already there at Sinai, and the development takes place according to the way that it's mapped out in the genome. Reb Tzadok's view is far more dynamic. The actors in the history of halacha, right, the individuals, the institutions, the people we're going to discuss tonight, Ezra, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, Shimon HaTzadik, and so on, they're dynamic. They're introducing new things, new ideas, new ways of thinking and experiencing that are brought to bear on halacha. The implication of the Reb Tzadok view is that there are crossroads in halachic history. There are moments where things can go one way or another. There's more room, paradoxically, in Reb Tzadok's view, there's more room for human intervention, and there's also more room for God's intervention. Paradoxical, because if you think about it, you know, for it's paradoxical because there's more room for God and there's more room for man. But if you think about it, for Rambam takes approach of, let's say, of what we would call Deus ex machina, right? God is outside of God is not directly involved in the process of development, and the Rambam would even say that if God is directly involved in the process, it disqualifies the process, right? A Navi, Nevuah, would make it problematic. Howdy. I gave two to Miriam. So. I should point out that Yoni's here that tonight's shiur is in memory of Miriam Leiba Bas Moshe Leib. Bas Leib Moshe. It's Yoni's mother, whose yahrzeit was on Shabbos?
Friday.
Thank you, Yoni, for, you know, for sponsoring the shiur for the next few weeks as well. So again, for Rambam, Deus ex machina. God is not involved. God cannot be involved in the development of halacha, and that would actually render it problematic. For Reb Tzadok, God is involved in the history of halacha on an ongoing basis. For Rambam, the development is completely top-down. Like we said before, it's part of the genome of halacha that's given at Sinai, right? And the way that he describes the Sanhedrin is that there's a single body that their interpretations are the correct interpretations by definition. They're the authoritative interpretations. Whereas with Tzadok, there's a lot more room for an emergent order, right? That the idea that the rules that are governing halacha are not preset. They weren't, the rules themselves were not given at Sinai, right? That the rules themselves are unstable. The rules don't follow rules. That at best we might be able to figure out and to know after the fact which course of action was the correct course of action, but in real time, it's very difficult to know. The fact that there's no rule, in the Rambam's model, there are 13 rules. These are the 13 rules by which we interpret the Torah. Right? The Yud Gimel Midot Shatorah Nidreshet Bahem. For Reb Tzadok, the rules themselves are a development. The rules themselves are something that come along later.
Those don't change.
You'd be surprised.
Do?
Yeah. He thinks that those rules themselves are historical. They develop, meaning the fact that we say Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Bishloshet Esrei Midot, HaTorah Nidreshet Bahem. This is attributed to Rabbi Yishmael. It was Rabbi Yishmael that said it. Rabbi Akiva had 7 rules. Rabbi Elazar had 32 rules. Right, that the rules themselves are subject to development. Even if we follow one, they're rules that developed and emerged at a particular point in time. There's a history to the rules, right? For Reb Tzadok, let's say, halacha develops similar to the way that language develops. Okay, it's an emergent order, right? There's no, the example that they use these days is nobody decided to turn Google into a verb. But we all use...
What prevents it from spinning out of control?
So what prevents it from spinning out of control? That's a great question. And the real answer is that we do. Right? Meaning that there's no way to a priori know, if there's no way to a priori know what kind of decision, what kind of development within the world of halacha is going to be accepted or not, except later on, except whether or not we accept it. And this is, right, it's, you end up saying things that like, Rabbi, what I like to say is, Rav Usher Weiss and Rav Avi Weiss might say the same thing, but if Rav Usher Weiss says it, it will have a lot more gravitas and a lot more credibility than if Rav Avi Weiss says it. Okay? There's a dynamic here of building credibility. And the rules and the correctness of the interpretation is only one element of that. Right? Other elements of that are, rhetoric, how it's, the rhetorical structure is embedded. The truth of the matter is that, and this is what I'm studying in my graduate research, and it's a brand new field, right? People are not used to thinking in the terms of, okay, what are these charismatic elements that go into trust? What is trust? I think it's a broader question. Like, when I decide that I'm going to trust this person, right, or trust their authority, or trust their decision,
that's the Masorah part of it.
Where does it come from?
That's the Rambam's Masorah, because the trust is
right,
made. Granted from Moshe to wherever, and there's your trust.
Well, so you can take an approach of these are the people you have to trust, but that's not how trust works. I'll tell you, I look at the history of halacha with a sense of wonder. Right? There's nobody ever decided. Nobody. There was no formal decision. Okay, Rav Moshe Feinstein is now going to be the Gadol HaDar.
Unless the system was put in place.
No, it didn't happen. No. Nobody made that decision. There was no formal election of Rav Moshe Feinstein as the Gadol HaDar. There's no official role of Gadol HaDar. There were always alternatives. There were always other people to ask. Right? And I would even flip it. I would say, it's not that his rulings are followed, right, or became authoritative because he was the Gadol HaDar. It's that he was the Gadol HaDar because everybody sought out his rulings and followed his rulings. Okay? I want to leave questions for the end. Is that all right? Okay. So yes, obviously you have to know a lot of Torah, and you have to understand the questions that people are asking. But that's only one part of the mix, and that's what makes the history of halacha unpredictable. It's what makes it spontaneous, and it makes it. That's why I find it endlessly fascinating. Okay. And the interesting thing is that we really don't know all that much about it, right? We talked last week. You know, you can ask the question, why did people ask for Moshe Feinstein? Why did people trust him? Why did people find him trustworthy? Last week we asked, why did people accept the Mishnah or Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's specific Mishnah? Or why did the mainstream of Jewish history follow the Mishnah at all, right? You can look at the legal writings that have been dug up at Qumran, and there were all kinds of legal writings that were found. So the this code, the that code, the purity code, the, documents that cover all different facets of life, right? When I grew up, what we learned was that the Tzedukim or the other sectarians during the time of Bayit Sheni, they didn't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. They didn't believe that there's such a thing as the oral law. Okay, so now that's true of the Karaites, which is a later development, right? Developed in the second half of the first millennium. But here we're talking 700-800 years before that. We're talking about the Tzedukim, and you're talking about the Dead Sea sect, the Essenes, and the differences between these different groupings are blurry, if they exist at all. But the question remains, the question becomes, yeah, they did have their own tradition. They did have a tradition of this is how you're supposed to interpret the Torah, which means that they did have a Torah Shebaal Peh, just not our Torah Shebaal Peh. So how did our Torah Shebaal Peh become, why did what we call our Torah Shebaal Peh become the Torah Shebaal Peh? Why was the Bavli chosen over the Yerushalmi? Right? These are all questions that, whenever you have a question where there are 10 different answers, it generally means that none of the answers are great answers. Okay? Or at least that we're trying to figure it out after the fact. These are not answers that were given a priori. Okay, so because there are certain questions that can't be answered, because there are certain things that we're just now developing the tools to understand. One of the things that we're going to be looking at is not necessarily the history of halacha, but the history of the history of halacha, meaning, or the sacred history of halacha, how Chazal, how Rambam, how Reb Tzadok, how they understood the history of halacha, right? Because it's a little bit meta, but it's, if we can see how Reb Tzadok understands, or how Rambam understands the development of Torah Shebaal Peh, that tells us a lot about how Rambam understands Torah Shebaal Peh, right? And if you can contrast Rambam with Reb Tzadok, then you see that, okay, there's a major movement, there's a major shift in terms of the history of Torah Shebaal Peh from Rambam to Reb Tzadok, even if neither of them tells us a tremendous amount about what happened in the periods that they're discussing. Okay. Reb Tzadok, well, I'll give a little bit of bio when we're going to see some Reb Tzadok inside. This is just, I started off tonight by, I wanted to sharpen a distinction that I made last week between the Rambam's view of the history of halacha and Reb Tzadok's view of the history of halacha, and why we're adopting, why I find that Reb Tzadok's view, Reb Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, he died around the year 1900. He was a Hasidic Rebbe. And we'll see some of his writings inside. Fascinating, right? His historical consciousness is very highly developed. So understanding how Chazal managed to persuade people that Torah Shebaal Peh, or their particular version of Torah Shebaal Peh, is part of what happened at Sinai, is itself part of the history. Understanding why the Bavli became canon and not the Yerushalmi is part of halachic history. what we have at the end, so you could ask, like, okay, this all sounds awfully postmodern, there is no grand narrative that's uniting the history of halacha, so why is it that, you know, why do we treat what we have in front of us today as something that originated at Sinai? What I think, meaning this is my best answer, and it works for me. The history of halacha is, amongst other things, it's an attempt to apply and understand what we received from the generations before us, knowing that those generations were doing the same thing, right? Meaning that there's this good faith effort to understand and apply what we're receiving. There's an article by Rav Nachum Rabinovich, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ma'ale Adumim, where he talks about the concept of Emunat Chachamim. Right now, Emunat Chachamim, right, means faith in the sages. Now, faith in the sages, it's sort of been distorted, right? It's interpreted today to believe that, yes, anything that a sage says, you have to believe it's true, you have to believe it's... He takes a much simpler, a much more elegant approach, and he says, no, what Emunat Chachamim is the belief, is the faith that in every generation, the sages made a good faith effort. They may have made mistakes, they may have misinterpreted things, they may have distorted things unintentionally, but they were trying to understand and they were trying to apply what they understood as God's word, as communicated at Sinai, to their own lives and to their own understanding of the world. So I think that's where the continuity is, right? That it's not in the rules themselves. It's not necessarily even in the rules for making the rules, but it's in this ongoing attempt to come to grips with, to understand, and to apply. There's a famous metaphor, Greek metaphor, called the ship of Theseus, right? And it's used in a variety of contexts to try to understand what exactly identity is. The fable of the ship of Theseus is that Theseus had a ship, and at some point one of the boards rotted, and so he replaced it. And then another one cracked, and so he replaced that. Sooner or later, every single component on his ship was replaced. So the question is it still the ship of Theseus? And then there are all sorts of corollaries. What if somebody took all of the discarded pieces and put them back together and fixed it up? So which one is the ship of Theseus? So it's a question of identity. Okay? So for us, right, even if we can say that, meaning we don't accept the Rambam's approach, we don't think that this is all embedded in the genome of Torah Shebaal Peh from Sinai, that there were things introduced, right? That it is more akin to the ship of Theseus, that things are being replaced. So what generates the continuity? What generates the continuity is the fact that, well, we're on the ship. And we never got off the ship. So this is the same ship because we're still on that same journey. Okay? So this is why I tend to prefer Reb Tzadok. Of course.
You wouldn't say the same thing about how some business developed over 200 years. The point is that there's hashgacha involved in the fact that it's happening.
Right, and that's what I said before about how when by allowing for more human input into the development of halacha, paradoxically, Reb Tzadok also allows for more divine input into the history of halacha because there's this ongoing shaping. You know, I would say progressive revelation, but that's, you know, that's something else. There is as it were, God's continuing to shape the Torah through the vehicle of the human mind, our mind, right? So this is, Reb Tzadok's model is a more human model, and it's also a more of a divine, an ongoing unfolding of divine consciousness, as it were. Okay, let's get back to the actual history. So last week we talked a little bit, you know, we looked at the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Moshe to Yoshua, Zakenim, and Nevi'im. And we talked about that in terms of how Chazal perceived periodization, how Chazal perceived the different seam lines in early Jewish history. Now, the truth of the matter is, we don't know all that much about what the Israelite religion looked like at the time of the first temple. And even if you look through Tanakh, the historical parts of Tanakh, all the way until the first, the beginning of Bayit Sheni, we don't learn all that much about Israelite religion. I'm going to pass out last week's source sheet, because we're going to take a look at the source that we didn't get to last time, which is the Nehemiah. But there are a few things, right? There's, let's say, take for a second the Book of Rut, right? So in the Book of Rut, we have this thing about people affecting a transaction by taking off their shoes, right? And Chazal have a hard time sort of working that back into the, what they, the halacha that they were familiar with. There are a few cases. Shlomo HaMelech observed Sukkot. Yoshiyahu observed Pesach. There was a Pesach at the time of Yehoshua. With Yoshiyahu, it says yes, and they observed Pesach, which, according to the Pshat, hadn't been observed in hundreds of years, and according to the, it hadn't been observed that well. It was observed, but the Pshat is that, it wasn't observed. And they find the Chumash, and he starts reading it, and he's like, oh my God, look at what it says in this book. And it seems that he was just completely unaware of what the Torah said. You have Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah keeping some form of kosher, right? That they wouldn't eat from the Patbag HaMelech when they were in Nebuchadnezzar's court. They wouldn't eat from what other people were eating from. And Daniel faces Jerusalem when he prays, which seems to be an innovation because it hadn't. He was the first one to do that. Yechezkel records all kinds of laws about what the priests have to do, and it seems there's parts of Yechezkel that seem to go against the Torah, right? They seem to say that, like, oh yes, a Kohen is not allowed to eat non-kosher meat. Just a Kohen? Really? So you have this picture that's almost, it's fuzzy, right? We don't really know all that much about what was being observed during the time of Bayit Rishon. And we know that people were sinning plenty. We know that there was plenty of idolatry. We know that there was plenty of private altars. So when we look and we say that, like, okay, what kind of tradition was there? To the extent that there was a tradition, we would have to posit that it was underground and that it was fragmentary. So there's really not all that much to say about what's going on with, the development of halacha from the time of Sinai until the beginning of Bayit Sheni. We just don't know a lot about what people were doing. And then we come to Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, so Ezra and Nehemiah, what Ezra does, and I'm going to use this, I use this term very deliberately. Ezra published the Torah. What I mean by that is, if you take a look at the first source on this week's source sheet, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Ezra changed the script of the Torah. Originally, it was in the ancient Hebrew script, like the kind that you can see if you go to the Shrine of the Book. And he changed the Torah to be to use Lashon Ashurit, right? The Assyrian script that we use a version of that today. Okay. Now, the Gemara there says something that seems pretty radical. says, originally it was Ktav Ivri, it was in the ancient Hebrew script, V'lashon HaKodesh, and it was in the Holy Tongue, it was in Hebrew. Chazra v'nitna lehem bimei Ezra, it was given to them again. The Torah was given to them again in the time of Ezra, v'ktav Ashurit, using the Assyrian script, v'lashon Arami, and in Aramaic. Biravu lehem liYisrael ktav Ashurit v'lashon HaKodesh. And the Israel themselves, they took one of each. So it seems like it's saying that Ezra, not only did he want to, did he change the script of the Torah, but he wanted to change the language of the Torah. Ezra wanted to re-give the Torah in Aramaic. Right? He wanted it to be that to be the language of the Torah. And the Jewish people sort of rebelled against that and say, no, we'll keep your script, but we're going to keep it in Hebrew. Right? And they left the ancient Hebrew script for the Samaritans. And then the Gemara goes on to say that had the Torah not been given to through Moshe, it would have been given through Ezra. That when it comes to lawgivers, Ezra is second only to Moshe. And even though, the last line of this Gemara, even though he didn't have the privilege of giving the Torah, he changed the Torah. Nishtina al yado haktav. Right? The script changed by his hand. Now, what does it mean that Ezra wanted to change the language of the Torah to Aramaic? Why would he want to do that? Vulgate was Latin. That was by Jerome in the 400s, 500s?
It was to make it
comprehensible.
Vernacular and accessible to the public.
Okay. So, like the Septuagint, you did have translations of the Torah that sort of supplanted the Torah. The Septuagint, that Philo, who was an Alexandrian Jew, didn't necessarily know the Torah in Hebrew. He knew it in Greek. With Ezra, I think there's something else going on here. Aramaic, at the time of Ezra, was not just a language that was a vernacular. It was the official language of the western part of the Persian Empire. Okay? If you take a look at Megillat Esther, you see very clearly that the Persian Empire is a vast regime, right? It goes from India to Ethiopia, and they built roads in order to administrate a massive empire like that. It was larger than any empire that the world had ever seen until that point. In order to administrate an empire like that, you need to have a functional bureaucracy in place. Each locale had its own rules written in the official documents, right? And the government, the central government, didn't necessarily know what was going on in all the different places. They gave a certain amount of autonomy, but there was this idea that, you know, there is this there is a rule of law, and laws are published. And you see it throughout Megillat Esther that they're constantly sending out letters by horse to all the reaches, all the furthest reaches of the empire. So Ezra sees this as an opportunity. Ezra was a sofer. He was a scribe. He was familiar with the text, with the Torah. And what he does is he publishes the Torah, meaning he makes it a public document. And he changes the script to the script that was used in all official communications. And he even wants to change the language to the language that's used in all official publications. Meaning, he wanted to take the Torah to take it away from being the provenance of, you know, these circles of scribes and priests and prophets, and make it part of the legacy of the entire people. And you see that clearly in the book of Ezra, right? That they open it up and they read it, and the next day they want to hear more, right? And Ezra comes and he reads the Torah to them, and they come back for more, right? And it even describes this situation where they're reading in the Torah and they read about this holiday at the beginning of Tishrei, and they had no idea that there's a holiday there. And they're all weeping because tonight is a holiday and we don't even know about this holiday. The holiday obviously is Rosh Hashanah. And they're weeping because they had never heard of it before. And then it says that they read about Sukkot. And then they go out to the hills and they start picking all these branches and stuff. They don't even know what to do with them. They're picking, it says that they pick Pri Etz Hadar, and they also pick olives, and they also pick Hadassim. Right? It's like, which one's which? They don't even know what they're picking. They don't even, are they using it for the Dalet Minim? Are they using it for the Sukkot? We don't even know. We just have the book. We finally have the book. We're finally reading it. We're finally able to figure it out. So I think that's what's going on with Ezra, right? That he's using, and it's specifically in that Persian context, in that bureaucratic context, that Ezra is able, he's able to leverage that, and he's able to leverage the authority that he has with the king, with the Persian emperor, in order to make the Torah, to turn the Torah into the law of the land that's visible for all to see. Okay? Now, one of the things that they do, and this is the last source in last week's packet, they made a pact. And the pact is described in the 10th chapter of Nehemiah. Right? V'chol zot anachnu kortim amana. We are making a pledge. We're making a pact. And then it goes and it lists about 85 people who were present, who signed on to this pledge. And then it goes through what are the individual pledges that they're pledging. So that starts Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Sher lo nitein benoteinu la'amei ha'aretz. We will not give our daughters to the people of the land. Ved benoteim lo nikach livneinu. And we are not going to take their daughters for our sons. Ve'amei ha'aretz all of those people of the lands who bring their things to sell, who bring their, you know, their merchandise to sell on Shabbat, lo nikach mehem b'Shabbat. We're not going to buy from them on Shabbat, v'yom kodesh, or on any other holiday. V'notesh et shana shvi'it u'masa kol yad. Okay, so now let's just take those two things, because we can do that with almost every element of this pact. The Torah talks about who Israelites are allowed to marry and who they're not allowed to marry. Who is an Israelite not allowed to marry according to the Torah? According to the Torah, an Israelite, a Jew, is not allowed to marry. So there's Ammoni and Moabi, and there's Edomi and Mitzri, and okay, there's a mom there. That's I'm saying in terms of nations, right? And then there are the Shiva Amamin, the seven nations of okay, the people that were living in Eretz Yisrael at that time weren't from any of those tribes. They were Ashdodim, they were Plishtim, they were Bechlal, they were transplants from the middle of, you know, from Central Asia, from northern Iran. What you have here is an extension, an expansion of the biblical mandate that these are the nations you're not allowed to intermarry with. And it's saying the people that live around here now, they have the same status. Now, commerce on Shabbat. Where does the Torah say you're not allowed to? I mean, we don't do commerce on Shabbat. That's not in the Torah anywhere. Right?
Maybe writing.
Hmm?
Maybe writing or receipts or something. At best.
Maybe. But here it's talking about commerce. Right? Now we think of that as being a Derabbanan. Who were the Rabbanan that made that Derabbanan? Right? You see it right here. This is where it's being legislated. Right? And it's not that he just pulled it out of a hat. It says that if part of the goal of Shabbat is for it to be a shvita, for it to be a day of no work and a day of rest, then engaging in commerce on Shabbat is likewise inappropriate, which is something that we can, you know, something that we can understand. But what's going on with this pact? Another example. In Pasuk Lamed Tet, it talks about giving Ma'aser to the Kohanim. V'haya ha-Kohen ben Aharon im ha-Leviim ba'aser ha-Leviim. Right, that Ma'aser was given to the Kohanim, to the Leviim. According to the Torah, Maaser is given to Kohanim. Maaser is given to Leviim. Truma is given to the Kohanim. Two separate gifts. Here, Ezra is saying, you know what? There was an imbalance. There were not a lot of Leviim who came back to Eretz Yisrael with Ezra. So Ezra's like, okay, new rule. You can give Maaser to Kohanim too. So what you have going on here is not just, I mean, there's a pact to uphold the Torah, but it's not just an upholding of the Torah, it's an expansion of the Torah. You have the first, sometimes it's interpretation, and sometimes it's outright expansion of the laws of the Torah. These are the first derabbanan. Now, the generation of Ezra and Nehemiah, around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was a group called the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the men of the great assembly. Now, there is one theory, right, and I think it's a fairly compelling theory, that the 85 people that are listed here, there's a Yerushalmi that says that there were 85 members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. This is the Knesset HaGedola, right? It's this great assembly where all the people came together and they made a pact that we are going to observe the Torah, we're going to uphold the Torah, and we're even going to accept these interpretations and expansions of the Torah. Okay, so I think that that's what's going on when we talk about the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. At the very least, this is the beginning of it. Now, interpretation of a text can only really begin when you have a stable text to begin with. And it's really only now, with Ezra's publication of the Torah, it becomes part of the public domain, that you have a stable text. And historically, too, the text of the Torah, the first real stable texts of the Torah that we have are from, you know, go back not further than this time, right? We know of the genealogy of the Torah. I mean, there are three main variants of the text of the Torah, right? There's the one that became the Septuagint, there's the one that became our Torah, the Masoretic Torah, and there's the Samaritan Torah. And the genealogy of them traces back to this time. This is where you first start to get a stable text, which means that before then, if you had different groups in different places, they were playing games with the Torah. There's another medrash that talks about how Ezra took a bunch of different Torah scrolls that he found in his time, and he made a composite. He made his best effort at finding the proper and original text of the Torah, which is a shocking thing to hear, especially given what we, you know, we're used to thinking that we're taught from a young age that every single letter of the Torah is exactly as it was given to Moshe at Sinai. That can't be. I mean, there are midrashim that say that explicitly, that it's not. That Ezra took these different texts and made this composite edited document out of them. Now, that's not quite the documentary hypothesis, but it's not what you were used to hearing. What's that? I think they make sense. So, in that sense, it's authoritative enough that if that's the reading that makes the most sense to me, then I feel comfortable going with that. Okay. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola, we're talking about around the time period, about the 5th century before the Common Era into the middle of the 4th century before the Common Era, right? Ezra lives in the 400s BCE, and it ends with the rise of Greece, the arrival of Alexander, which is in around 330 BCE, so about 100 years, about a century, maybe a little bit more, at the end of the Persian era. What I want to look at now is how some of the what I want to look at now are things that we're not going to get to tonight because it's already 8:55. But let's at least take a look at let's finish up what we were saying about Ezra. And if we look at the second source in today's packet, this is a drusha of the Chatam Sofer. It was delivered about 200 years ago. He was born in 1762, died in 1839. And he was sort of obsessed with the idea of the Torah's translation and the transmission of the Torah. He starts off, he's interpreting the Gemara in Sanhedrin that we saw. He says, "Hainyan shebetchila ketav hakodesh halaz she'enu mishtamshim bo ata haya ganuz besefer Torah sheba'aron hakodesh v'yadyotim hayu mishtamshim b'ketav livona." Originally, they would just use the ancient ketav Ivri. V'ata Ezra. And then Ezra came. U'matar ketav hakodesh l'chol b'nei Yisrael. And he gave that holy script, Ketav Ashurit, meaning he's adopting the position that the Torah was originally given in Ketav Ashurit, but Ketav Ashurit was hidden until Ezra brought it back. So he made that something that was available to all Jews. Tam Bazeh, the reason he did that, Mishum be'osheba otiyota Torah v'tziratan, v'tagin, v'kotzin, v'rumazim, Torah sheba'al peh, v'kol ma'a she'talmid v'atik, Atib Chadesh, that somehow the shape of those letters with all of the little curlicues, with all of the little crowns, that's part of what makes the Torah Sheba'al Peh, that's what alludes to the Torah Sheba'al Peh within the Torah Sheba'al Peh. As long as the Torah Sheba'al Peh was transmitted orally, they didn't need to look in the text. And they didn't need to pick up on the allusions. And this connects with what we were saying last week about Otniel ben Kenaz, right? That as long as that we compensate for a certain immediacy, a certain intimacy with intellect. So it was only later on that this oral tradition was in some way interrupted, we needed to change the script, so that those allusions would be there to interpret through the process of reading. Mirimizot hakra. So originally, they just looked at it when they needed to, the Nevi'im and the Chachamim. Amnam be'avonotenu harabim. Right, there's four lines from the end of that passage. Be'avonotenu harabim, due to our sins, mishagolta hashchina, when God's presence went into exile, v'yardach shikcha la'olam, and the world became, forgot things. Kemo shebo l'sof hutzrach Rabbeinu HaKadosh l'chtov Torah Sheba'al Peh. He turns Ezra into an analog of Rabbeinu HaKadosh. The same way that Rebbe had to write down the Mishnah because he saw that that was necessary to preserve the Torah Sheba'al Peh, Hachanami, so too, bimei Ezra in the time of Ezra, hutzrach al kol panim limsor simanei Torah u'rumazel leklal Yisrael. They had to give the tools to of all of those allusions, right? All of the allusions and all of the hints and all of those aspects of the Torah that are elusive. Kedei sheyedu lahotzi adin mirumizei hakra, so that they would know one in it, so that they would know how to determine the halacha through these allusions. And that's what it means, that it was in the generation of Ezra that the Torah was as though it was given again. right? That he regave it in a sense that they were given the tools to derive law from the text itself and from the allusions of the text. We'll pick it up with Andrei Knesset HaGedola next week.